Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies. I'm Adam McNeil, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Professor Nikki Taylor, who has authored the book Driven Toward Madness, The Future Slave Margaret Garner and Tragedy on the Ohio. And she comes to us from Howard University. And so, welcome, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you so much. It is quite an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so we're very happy to have you on the channel today because your particular book is it's very deep. It's very deep. And it's also an important story that really needs to be told. So before we get any further, definitely thank you for your scholarship.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And I'm just really grateful that it is having the kind of impact that it's having. It's totally took me by surprise.
Absolutely, 100%. So before we get into the book, we really like to let our listeners here know about the intellectual trajectory that really brought you to this project. So if you don't mind briefly giving us a really understanding and a grounding of really where you come from in this story and why also why Margaret Garner? As well.
Okay, well, I am from Toledo, Ohio, which is about 3 hours north of Cincinnati. And Cincinnati is the central location of many of my intellectual projects. I attended the University of Pennsylvania for undergraduate and then Duke University for my master's and PhD. I have had impactful experience at Duke University, where I studied under historian Peter Wood and Sidney. Mm-hmm. And that's where I got interested in the history of free Blacks. So that's very different than what most people who do 19th century slavery study. Most people who do African-American history study slavery. So I wanted to study the history of free Blacks. And in the history of free Blacks, I've always focused on citizenship, the struggle for justice, the struggle for freedom. And so this project, Driven Toward Madness, is really a departure from that in a lot of ways. And it really forced me to stretch beyond what I was accustomed to writing about and delve into the darker sides of American slavery.
Wow, that is... So that's outstanding. That's outstanding. And so say you're from Ohio and you went to Duke, and some outstanding scholars definitely come out of Duke. And I definitely believe with this particular book, Driven Toward Madness, you definitely give that tradition an extension as well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I've had a lot of great and important scholars have come out of Duke University. Of course, it's an honor to have attended that program in that time. And so, yeah, they trained us really well, a very rigorous program that probably over-prepared me in a lot of ways for the academy. So I'm very appreciative for the rigor of that program because it allowed me to be able to do a lot of things. My first book was on urban history, Free Blacks in Cincinnati. The second one was on an intellectual history project, which again, was nothing that I had ever done. So that was really a stretch. And then this one, went back to the basics. I got my certificate in women's studies from Duke. And so this allowed me to bring in all of the knowledge and insight that I had gained there to be able to, bring that all to bear in this project.
Wow, that's outstanding. And so I guess since we're on the topic of mentors, are there any particular mentors specifically besides your folks at Duke, Peter Wood and such that really helped you get to where you are today?
The list is endless, but one in particular, I think, and people might be surprised because it isn't a Black woman, but his name is Paul Finkelman, and he's the foremost scholars of law and constitutional history. And so he was the first one to give me my first contract. And so he continued to mentor me after that. And so he was one of the ones that was the earliest champions of this project in its various forms as I was writing.
Wow, that's well, actually, for this particular book, he definitely would have come in handy. That's for sure. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And so let's get on into the book. So, you know, you talked briefly about this book being a relative departure from your story about free blacks of the period. So how about talking to us about how you really got to specifically this project out of all the projects?
Yeah, definitely. The first book, I mentioned Margaret Garner, but because her story was so uncomfortable for me, I just rushed through it in the first book. It was uncomfortable because I couldn't fathom the idea that a mother could, you know, kill her child. And so it took a lot of growth and evolution for me to come back to the project and, you know, be able to embrace it with some maturity and some perspective to be able to really understand what her world was like as an enslaved woman. And so she's something that I was very familiar with because I, like I said, my first book was on Frontiers of Freedom, was on the Free Black Community of Cincinnati. And so she factors into that when she makes her escape into that city. Of course, I was also aware of her life through the phenomenal novel, Beloved, by Toni Morrison, and then the film adaptation by the same name. And so all of those things left an impression on me, but I never thought I would be the one to write a biography that centers her and reclaims her voice, a real history book about her that in a lot of ways speaks to and differs from Toni Morrison's piece. So it's definitely, you know, it was a journey for me, but you know, I'm really glad that I did the project.
Absolutely. And I definitely believe our listeners either are or definitely will be after they pick this book up. And also, just to let everyone know who might have come in a little late, the scholar that we have in front of us now is Dr. Nikki Taylor from Howard University. And the book that we're talking about right now is Driven Toward Madness, The Fugitive Slave Margaret Garner and Tragedy on the Ohio. And, you know, it's interesting as well. I did not get to mention this offline, but I have a little connection to Kentucky as well.
Oh, wow. What's your connection?
Right. So I actually, I used to intern in the summer of 2013 at Abraham Lincoln Birthplace National Historical Park, actually in Hodgenville, Kentucky. You know, so it's, you know, so this particular story about, you know, the concept of borders, and the concept of, you know, Ohio in comparison to Kentucky, because obviously they're very close. But at least I think I would say, like to say in our minds, in our maps about, you know, what's the north and what's the south. I think that's the convergence that's really one of the most intriguing. And it blends in definitely well into this story.
Yeah, definitely wouldn't have this story had it not been for Kentucky. Right. So a lot of people don't know that it is really borderland area. On one side of the river, the Ohio River, you have Kentucky, a slave state. On the other side, you have Ohio, which slavery never touched the state of Ohio. It was part of the Northwest Territory, so it was one of the few states that never allowed slavery, but yet slavery touched Ohio in so many ways, as such as this story demonstrates. And so oftentimes the two states clashed when it came to slavery and fugitive slaves. And so it's an important area. A lot of people focus on Philadelphia and New York and Boston as sites of the Underground Railroad. But I argue in my first, second, and this book that this part of the country was just as combative. The two sides really came to clashes just as much as the eastern cities.
No, and I'm so glad that you said that, considering the fact that I am now sitting at in Simmons College in Boston. So I actually do work right now with Boston African American National Historic Site. And so, you know, we talk about the Underground Railroad, but we have people like Lewis Hayden and others who, you know, were involved from Kentucky. And so, you know, the parallels are very, very strong.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you know that. So we, you know, I don't have to, you know, go over that part of this history, but it's really, and then I should say too, not only is Ohio Northern, but it's also Western, the Western city for much of its early history. Because at one point that was the frontier of America. And so a lot of the culture that comes with frontierism was present in a city like Cincinnati, where people often resorted to mob violence and, you know, bloody violence in order to protest abolitionists and abolitionist activity. So it's a very, it was a hotbed of intolerance on one hand, but it also was a very strong community for anti-slavery activism.
Absolutely, 100%. And so, you know, you speak about this briefly in your intro. You know, when you talk about how you really structured this particular project, you know, it's something that I wrote a little bit about. Harriet Tubman and Nell Irvin, Painter, spoke about how it was writing about a particular individual, a very historic individual who did not leave physical, you know, primary source documentation that was authored on their hand. And so, as we go into the book, you know, can we get you to speak particularly about how you went about, you know, your process at which you came about writing this particular book?
Thank you for mentioning that. Of course, when one is trying to do a project on 19th century African American history, particularly African-American women's history, we have a troubled archive. It's a very troubled archive. And what do I mean by that? Because African-Americans were largely uneducated, or what some would call illiterate, uneducated in a formal way, they didn't often leave direct written records, diary entries, letters. And so it becomes very difficult to reclaim their voices and to reclaim their real sense of agency and purpose, because the historical record is very raced. A lot of the documents are written by powerful white men, newspaper editors, plantation owners, legislators, senators, and the such. And in addition to that, the archive is gendered in a way that precludes women's voices. Women were not at that time considered political actors. They were often not allowed to leave their own records as well. So in Black women, you have the intersection of all of that, which means their archive is even doubly or even triply troubled. And what do I mean by that is that it's very hard to find direct evidence from them. So it takes a very different type of historical methodology to be able to reclaim these voices. Nell Painter is one of the pathbreakers in doing that with her book on Sojourner Truth. And we know that others who have written about people like Harriet Tubman, also Margaret Garner, it's very difficult. So you can either just conclude, as some of my students in my Howard history class on Black women's history, well, you know, why do people write books when there's not a lot of evidence? And I say, because we must try to reclaim their voices, because we have this movement now called Black Lives Matters, where Black voices matter too, and Black history matters. So those voices in history matter. And so we have to dig in untraditional places in order to be able to recover their voices. So what do I mean by that? We have the records of these great white powerful men, and they may only mention Black women in a passing way. And so we take a piece here, we take a piece there. And then when you put it all together, you start to have more clarity of what life must have been like for these women. And so you, as a scholar of African-American history, and as a scholar of African-American women's history, a scholar and a historian of that history, I felt duty-bound to reclaim this voice of this very troubled soul who, through her life and her biography, really demonstrated and spoke out in thunder tones in the records, despite having a lack of, you know, traditional records. She spoke out in thunder tones about what happened to her on that farm in Kentucky in the 1850s. And so it became almost like a passion for me to be able to continue to write her story, because by writing her story, I felt like I was writing the story of so many enslaved Black women who had a similar experience, but who remained voiceless because A, we don't have enough historians, because B, the historians we do have often shy away from this kind of difficult historical research. Another thing that I did to reclaim her voice was I had to almost jettison my discipline. I had to throw off the yoke of the discipline of history, which through it, most of its main methodologies is very European, very white, and it kind of privileges through default the voices of powerful white men and women. And so I had to throw off the methodologies and opt for more of an interdisciplinary approach. And one of the main frames that I use is Black feminist theory.
Okay, definitely. Yeah.
So I used it from my days at Duke. You know, I learned about Black feminist theory and why it matters in disciplines. And so what I did, one of the main purposes of Black feminist theory as applied in a discipline like history is, number one, to reclaim the voices of those whose voices had been muted. And so Margaret Garner is someone, she's an example of a voice that had been muted. So that's one of the main goals of utilizing Black feminist theory. Another one is to rescue Black women from stereotypes, which I try to do in one of the later chapters of the book, the stereotype of her as an infuriated Negress, and that's in quotes, which is, you know, just another phrase for an angry Black woman. And so I try to rescue her from that. Black feminist theory also privileges Black women and the people who they love. So her family is very central to this story, and their experiences are deeply connected to hers, which is another aspect of Black feminist theory. It argues that Black women are very much connected to other people. So in as much as her experience was her own, we can't understand it without also understanding what her husband endured, what her children endured, what her mother-in-law endured. And so that's the lens that I used. And, you know, I think by using that kind of a lens, I think one of the main comments that people say about this book is, number one, it doesn't read like a history book, which I thought was, I think that is good. And then it really, really makes her experiences front and center, and you get a real sense of who she was as a person. And so that's why, you know, that's what I was hoping to accomplish by jettisoning my discipline and using Black feminist theory, but also utilizing other approaches, including some psychology approaches. I used Nell Painter, who we've been quoting before. Her theory, Soul Murder, I applied as well to this project. So it's a little bit of everything. And I think that it makes it more accessible. It's an easy read. I think most people have told me they read it within a couple of hours, the whole book cover to cover. And so that's good. I think that you know, was an exercise for me of just evolving as a writer, and not just writing for the academy, but making my book means something to other people who are outside of the discipline and outside of the academy.
And that is exactly why all of that is exactly why I wanted to have you on here for my first interview. And to any listeners who might not know who this particular voice is, but I'm a new host, and I was definitely intrigued to have Dr. Taylor on the show, not only on the show, but as my first interview, because of really the excavation that she really produced for Driven Toward Madness, and in part, you know, you talked about Black feminist theory, you talked about a bit of the psychology, and you said Paul Finkelman, talked to him because of the law aspect. So there's a lot of moving parts here.
Yeah, exactly. And then I have the history of emotions. I also have some trauma studies theories that I've used in here as well. So it's just a lot of different things. And I think it allowed me to stretch as a historian and in order to borrow from disciplines who do theory so much better than historians. But yet, the book is not theoretical at all. I just used it as an approach and as a strategy for writing. But the book in and of itself is not theoretical. So I don't want the readers to be scared away by
it. Everybody, just disclaimer, this is definitely a book for everybody. Just let everyone know. Don't want to get anyone scared away, like Dr. Taylor said. And really on that particular point, as well, to any listeners, hey, who might be historians, hey, throw that yoke off, as Dr. Taylor said. Sometimes you just got to do it to be able to produce phenomenal work like Dr. Taylor did for Driven Toward Madness. And so getting particularly into the life of Margaret Garner, can you give us a brief synopsis of kind of the history of Margaret Garner that puts her into this moment in the mid-1850s?
Yeah, she was enslaved on a farm in northern Kentucky. A lot of people assume that Kentucky had plantations like they had in the Low Country, South Carolina, North Carolina, but it was a farm. And as such, she was very isolated in a lot of ways from a larger, more vibrant Black community of enslaved people. And so she labored on the farm just with a handful of other slaves from time to time. I think he never had more than 12 or 13 slaves, her owner. And she started having children as a teenager. And by the time she left, she had four children. She was just in her early 20s with four children and pregnant with another. She lived on a farm and her husband was enslaved across the street and down the road. And he lived on that farm. Her husband was Robert Garner. He lived on a farm with his father, his mother. And so they were quite a distance away from Margaret Garner. And so she had to do the caretaking of not only the white family who owned her, the Gaineses, round the clock slavery. I mean, a lot of people wrongly believe that the people, slaves who worked in the house, so to speak, had a very cushy lifestyle. But she literally worked around the clock inside and outside of the house, serving the family, but also serving her four children. She was effectively almost like a single parent with the father of her children living on another farm, as well as her in-laws. And her mother and her father are not in the picture by the time she became a mother. So, I mean, it was a really sad existence in a lot of ways. She was subjected to abuse, which I demonstrate in my book, Physical Abuse. She had a scar on her face that would attest to the nature of her owner's mentality in terms of abuse. She also may have been subjected to sexual assault. And I talk about that in the book as well, and how I arrived at that. And so she and her husband, although he was enslaved by an owner who lived down the road, he was hardly ever in the vicinity because he was hired out around northern Kentucky. So he was very rarely at home in the location where the story takes place. And her father-in-law, who was Robert's father, was also absent for dozens of years. He had been hired out in another location in central Kentucky. So that's the story of this family. And, you know, it was a lot of transition for the men. they had far more mobility than Margaret Garner or her mother-in-law, who was named Mary. And those women largely stayed enslaved on their farms for most of their lives. Now imagine living somewhere and never leaving that location. Where you live is also where you work, is also where you're being abused, is also where you are being raped. And it's just, it was just a horrific experience for her. And so it challenges this idea that slavery in the North was any more humane, that slavery inside the household was any more humane. And in fact, it turns that on its head. And I kind of argue that perhaps this was a worse type of slavery, if you think about it, especially within the absence of a strong Black community. And so that was her life in Kentucky. It was a very sad life. And when she and her family decided to escape slavery on that very frigid January night of 1856, it was quite an exceptional act. Not many enslaved people were escaping from Kentucky at the time, and certainly not many traveled with an entire family intact. And so that's what they attempted to do. And so this book follows them on that journey. It follows them across the Ohio River. And it follows them into Cincinnati, where they were eventually doggedly pursued by Margaret's owner, Archibald K. Gaines. And so it's a riveting story, you know, a story of lost hope, the hope where they thought they had made it to safety. And just when they thought they had arrived to safety in the free state of Ohio, they realized that her owner had followed them. And so it's just the story about an act of desperation that probably was not as desperate as maybe we might believe. And she ended up killing one of her children and tried to kill all the others as well. And so that's what this book is about. So that's why I'd say it's very deep, it's moving, and it's complicated when you think about motherhood and what a mother is willing to sacrifice for their kids' freedom.
Absolutely. And when I think about, you know, telling the history of even, you know, a place like Boston and telling people that, hey, guys, from, you know, the 1640s on to 1783, slavery actually happened. So that bad thing that you're talking about that you think is a Southern story, it's really not. And so this story brings that up. And also it also brings up for me. So like even just casually, like listen to like Malcolm X in like the 1960s, him saying, you guys, we need to stop talking about the South. You know, if you're south of the Canadian border, you're south. And in this story.
Exactly. And this story is also exceptional because, and I think I start the book this way, Black women rarely committed violent acts while enslaved. And so it's very different. It's a very different moment when she decided to kill her children. And so when we look at the resistance of Black women during slavery, most of the time Black women resorted to what we call covert forms of resistance, poisoning the food, spitting in the food, maybe committing arson, and things like that. But Black women rarely resorted to armed violence, so to speak. And so Margaret Garner's story just reveals that in as much as she was atypical, the things that she experienced were typical. So it's leading me in a different direction for my fourth book. And so I'm looking for more examples of Black women who, resorted to armed violence to escape slavery or to make some political statement about slavery. And so that book inspired the fourth book, which is in progress.
Oh, wow. And definitely at the end of this particular interview, we'll definitely have to catch up on that particular part for sure. And so, you know, when you talk about, you know, even the history of something like the Fugitive Slave Act, you know, which is really the story that makes the escape of Margaret Garner and her family not ineffectual, but it would be much different if it was done in 1849, for example. And it also makes me think about something in public culture recently, even the story of Underground, right? The television show, which I'm not sure, some people might not have seen it, but it was a show, as the name goes, on WGN America, about the story of a fictional group of people who flee from the South and end up in what was depicted as Ohio. But even once they were in Ohio, that didn't mean that they were actually free.
Exactly. That's true. And, you know, even though Ohio was a free state, as you say, you know, the fact is that after 1850, that freedom was tenuous for African Americans in Ohio. And so many of them tried to move further north to cities like Detroit and even onward to Canada. So there was no safe place for African Americans after the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, when you talk about, you know, Margaret Garner's particular story, can you speak a little bit more about, you know, what happened as the arbiters of the law effectively are dialing in on Margaret and her particular family, and kind of talk to us a little bit more about that particular scene and kind of, I guess, try to paint the picture. Kind of because when I think about this particular story, there's so many different variables at play here. And as much as you can in this particular time, would you be able to do that for us, please?
Yeah, well, definitely. The Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, although it was a compromise between, you know, slave states and free states, and I'm sure people know that story, the particular aspect of that law that affected African Americans directly was a stronger fugitive slave law, which effectively allowed for regular citizens, and this is important, regular random citizens to become deputized in the recapture of fugitive slaves. And so what that meant is that any white person could just join in and help seize and capture and bring presumed fugitive slave to justice. It also, the law also had a low standard for proving that someone was your fugitive slave. So, yeah, it was a very low standard. So what could happen is that a free Black person could be accused of being a fugitive slave and have not only have random white people in their community deputized to take them into captivity, but then, you know, all somebody had to do was say, hey, you know, a Southerner had to do was testify and say, oh, yeah, I remember her. She grew up around my way. And that was it. You were remanded into slavery just that easily. There were also different aspects of the law that kind of put more, there was more of a reward, I guess, more of the judges that presided over, magistrates that presided over these cases, got more for remanding a presumed slave to slavery than they did for freeing the slave. So there was an impetus, I guess, or, you know, an enticement for these magistrates to rule in favor of the slaveholders or presumed slaveholders. And so all of that really made, you know, African Americans feel like there was no justice. There was no getting around this law. Anybody could at all accuse them of being a fugitive slave. Anybody at all could deputize themselves and bring them into custody. And then in addition to that, it kind of tainted the magistrates and made them lean towards, ensuring that the person would be sent to slavery with the higher, costs or the higher, payment, a higher payment to the magistrates. Yeah. When they return somebody to slavery versus set them free. And so all of those things created a situation and a feeling that there was no no justice. There was no reprieve. The justice system was tainted. The law was tainted. The Congress people who passed the law were skewed towards slavery. And so it just, you know, a lot of African Americans made an exodus out of the country at that time into Canada. So when we look at Black Canadians, many of them, their ancestors came during that, you know, after 1850 because of the fugitive slave law. So that's the situation that Margaret Garner was up against. So when her owner doggedly pursued her into Cincinnati, just following the trail that they left in the snow and in the ice that night that they left, he quickly went to the magistrate and got what he needed to go back, return to the house. He brought with him some deputized whites and, you know, proceeded to break down the door of the home where they were hiding. And that's what it is. It's just this situation where white people at the time could and did simply just enter Black homes without warrant, without any just cause. And so Black people were really vulnerable at that time, both slave and free, because of that law and also the laws that didn't provide equal protection for them. And so so that's what happened when he broke into the door of the Elijah Kite's home in order to reclaim Margaret Garner and her children who belonged to him. It just created a firestorm of events. Her husband first tried to resist, and then she, you know, feeling like the walls were literally closing in on her, did what she had to do in order to try to free her children from the misery, a lifetime of misery that she knew firsthand slavery would produce for them.
Wow, that's definitely a vivid picture. Because when we talk about that particular scene, what comes to my mind, honestly, as you're painting the picture, is of really, you know, I think about there's a particular song Harry Belafonte did, "Oh Freedom," you know, and before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. That particular song, whenever I speak and I think about what enslaved people were up against, and in particular, as you were saying, when she felt like the walls were caving in on her, she did what, you know, she did what she did. And, you know, it's definitely something that as you talk about, you know, these equal protection, these, you know, honestly, if I would have shut my eyes and not known this book was here, Driven Toward Madness, that is, it would have almost sounded eerily similar to what African Americans, you know, had faced in the 20th century with the police state or the carceral state. And so when people try to talk about these particular parallels between, you know, the past, you know, the African-American past and the African-American present, and potentially also the African-American future, there's so many webs that connect and they go right into that particular moment with Margaret Garner, at least in my estimation.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
Absolutely. And so when this particular moment happens, what's the aftermath? How is it being depicted in newspapers, abolitionists? How is the world around what happened with Margaret Garner? How do they actually take in this particular information?
Yeah, well, and this is interesting because the bloodiness of the scene when you know, the crowd that had gathered outside of the Elijah Kite's house to watch the white deputies, self-styled deputies, break into the home of this free Black man, Elijah Kite, in Cincinnati in order to reclaim his cousin, Margaret Garner, and her family and extended family. You know, when the deputies first brought the baby out of the house, the crowd gasp in horror. I mean, this was a baby that was nearly decapitated. And they looked and all of her children had blood on them, you know, from her attempting to murder all of them. And the one that died probably got the worst of it, but she had another little girl that she damaged pretty bad too, which I talk about in the book. And so people were horrified, but immediately there was a level of sympathy for her in the Black community of Cincinnati, particularly among Black women. And so I talked to my students at Howard about this. I said, there was this rambunctious crowd of Black women that went to the courthouse every day. They tried to follow along as the prisoners were being led from the jail to the courthouse. And they got a little feisty with the sheriff's office, you know, at times. And I said, well, these women basically had a great amount of sympathy for Margaret Garner because she was them and they were her, right? And so they understood how difficult of a choice she had in that moment. There was a level of support for her among the Black women, first of all, abolitionists in Cincinnati and beyond throughout the nation immediately sympathized with her because although Margaret Garner had killed her baby, she didn't intend for it to be a political act. It became politicized because of just the division in the country along geographical and slavery lines. And so it became a political act without her intending it to become a political act. So abolitionists interpreted as, oh, this was an indication of how horrific slavery was. They talked about the implications of sexual abuse. And Sarah Remon was among those. And so was Lucy Stone. And so was Frederick Douglass, who hailed Margaret Garner a hero. A lot of people were surprised to learn that Frederick Douglass considered her a hero, and he named her. He named her in the pantheon of Black heroes in his day, including Crispus Attucks and Nat Turner. And so he named Margaret Garner. So that's where the Black community, the Black women in Cincinnati, Black activists, and white abolitionists considered her a hero. They considered, and they had a great amount of empathy for her situation. And then on the other side of it, the Southerners, who were not all slave owners, but yet a lot of them sympathized with slave owners for some odd reason. And so they you know, considered her, in, as I said earlier, an infuriated Negress. They thought she was a mad woman. They said she was particularly evil and vicious. And so there was these two Margaret Garners, so to speak. How could there be two Margaret Garners? How can she be an angel and a hero on one hand and this demon on the other hand? And so my book navigates through both of those to try to find out, well, what's going on here? And so I argue that both sides used a lot of hyperbole to paint whatever vision of Margaret Garner they wanted to paint. And so she became a symbol on both sides of the fence. And, you know, here she was just, you know, trying to do what she could to protect or save her children from, as you say, this type of death that they would surely face while enslaved on the Gaines farm. You know, she never intended to be an abolitionist when she did that, and nor did she intend to be in the national media. She just literally wanted to save her children from what she considered to be the horrors of slavery.
Absolutely. And you know, on that particular point, you know, really humanizing her and taking her out of the political discourse and just thinking about this just as a human act. Because humans are just, we're just a mixed bag, right? You know, and so it sometimes, you know, you get into these philosophical debates with people about, you know, oh, what would you do, this and this. First of all, I don't think you necessarily want to be in that situation, for one. And two, I don't think anyone knows what you would particularly do, because the spectacular is only spectacular because it's abnormal. And so, you know, this particular story with Margaret Garner, it especially in how you paint the picture for the listening and reading audiences, it is just like that. It's not linear in one way or the other. because in many ways it wasn't meant to be. It was just supposed to be an act that she produced.
Exactly. And, you know, I had something I wanted to let the listeners know that, you know, as I said, I started this project and I had written about her very quickly in my first book. And as a mother myself, I couldn't imagine what she did. And the very last sentence of the book, which is the last sentence of the book that I actually wrote, I wrote my acknowledgments last. And the last sentence of my acknowledgments on page, Roman numeral page 16, it finally clicked. I was talking about my daughter, and then a rush came over me, just a rush filled me. And the last sentence I wrote of my daughter, she embodies what Margaret Garner may have dreamed of for her own daughters, a life pregnant with possibilities, hope, and boundless freedom. And in that moment, Adam, I got it. It's like, and it makes the hair on my neck crawl just to think about how the very last sentence of the book, I finally got what she wanted for her children. Is not always about what she was running from, but what she wanted for her children on a deep level, boundless freedom, a life pregnant with possibilities and hope. And so I got it. And I couldn't imagine what it would be to raise a child without those opportunities, without that hope, without that boundless freedom for them. And to only expect a life of slavery and rape. I can't imagine that. So in that moment, I never again said what I would do if I were her, right? I never again said that. I never again judged her negatively for her decision because I did not live in that moment. My child, my girl, my baby girl didn't live in that moment. So I can't imagine any other alternative that would have been better than the one she tried in that moment.
Absolutely. And I remember, reading through this book and getting to that particular quote that you just did at the end of the acknowledgments, because, you know, as you said, you know, a life pregnant with possibilities. Yeah. And I think sometimes we take for granted being able to look towards a future and actually be able to see a picture that you actually like.
Exactly. And that's everything, you know, it's wrapped into freedom and it's wrapped into hope. We're forward looking people now. Mm-hmm. But what if you lived in a moment where there was no future? Where your future was your past, it was your present, but there was nothing better ahead. And so that's, you know, one of the things that, you know, still resonates with me about her life is, you know, the lack of choices that she had.
Absolutely. And on that particular point, you know, you spoke about, you know, not judging Margaret Garner on her actions, because as you said, you know, you really don't want to even put yourself in that kind of mind frame. And that last part about hope and boundless freedom, you know, when you talk about, you know, when you ask a conventional person on the street, you know, what does freedom mean to you? They'll speak about all these grandiose, you know, things from the American Revolution or the founding of the United States of America. But if you're African American, boundless freedom was in you, because, you know, the human soul, you know, yeah, not being, you know, enslaved, but, you know, maybe not, but thinking about not allowing what is in your present to impede your visions of the future. And sometimes as you wrote about in this book, in many ways, that vision of the future is involved in just breathing and living another day.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Thank you for saying that so eloquently.
Yes, absolutely. And definitely thank you for the particular work that you produced here, because it's definitely been, you know, the time is just flowing by and I'm just like, wow, we can definitely do this all day. And so if you don't mind, in the last couple minutes that we have you, would you be able to give us a particular history about what happens to Margaret Garner after this particular moment? And really how she's used, not only in that particular time frame in the late 1850s, but also going further in time as well, that bleeds into Toni Morrison being able to write about her in the 20th century.
Yeah, you know, rather than giving away too much to you.
Of course. Yeah,
I'll say that she has a very sad few years after that, and then she dies in her 20s. And, you know, her life, her kids, and everyone except her husband disappear from the historical record. I literally tried my best to locate her descendants, her children, by looking through the trails that historians use, and they disappear. Like so many of our ancestors and the ancestors of your listeners, they disappear, not literally, but I mean figuratively, from the historical record. No one ever mentions her kids because they only had first names in the slave schedules and things like that. They disappear from our view. And so that's sad to me. A woman who went blazing into the pages of the history books to have, you know, just a few years of life after that, very sad years. She was sent south to the deep south, being sold down the river. That's literally what happened to her. And to have her children, even the one in her womb, disappear. I have no idea what happened to her children that remain. One of the little girls had another horrific fate, almost as horrific as the fate of her sister, who was killed by Margaret Garner. So that happened within, you know, a month of Margaret killing the first little girl. So now, you know, within a month, two of her female children are dead. And then within 2 to 3 years, she's dead. And, you know, we don't know what happens to her sons or her parents-in-law, her husband's parents. And so she disappears. And it wasn't until Toni Morrison revived her through her novel, Beloved, and she revived her in a fictional character named Seth. And Seth's life is very different from the life of the real historical Margaret Garner, but the story is very powerful, Beloveds, in the story of Seth. And so, you know, I was very fortunate to have those shoes to walk in or to guide me as I had to, you know, create this history of Margaret Garner. And so, like Toni Morrison, I talk a lot about trauma, and memories are important, and scars that never heal. All of those motifs that she uses are actually real things that happen to Margaret Garner in so many ways. And so Toni Morrison revived her. And then there is a man by the name of Steven Weisenberger, who wrote a book about the case called Modern Medea. But in that book, he's an English professor by training. So the book is not, you know, as historical as maybe a historian's book would have been. And Margaret Garner is lost in the pages. He focuses mostly on the legal struggle over her between Ohio and Kentucky, and doesn't really give that much life to who she was as a woman. So I'm the first Black woman to write this book about Margaret Garner. And, you know, there's only a handful of books about enslaved women, or biographies about enslaved women who waged violent resistance. Another one is Celia, a Slave by Milton McLaurin. And so there are just a few of those like that. And so, that's the history of what happened to her and the history of her history.
Well, hey, listeners, this story is definitely one that you all should definitely pick up. And once again, we're talking with Dr. Nikki Taylor, professor of history and department chair in history at Howard University in Washington, D.C. And this book, Driven Toward Madness, The Fugitive Slave, Margaret Garner, and Tragedy on the Ohio, is definitely a book by Ohio University Press that you all definitely need to pick up. Because if you think that this story here that she's laid out is good, just wait until you read it. And so, like I said, in the last couple minutes that we have you, you had spoken about a particular project that you have in the works. And just so that we all can know what's next in your working life. And so can you tell us a bit about that project, if you don't mind?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I'm working on a book about enslaved women who participated in armed revolt or armed revolution in various ways, either through participating in slave insurrections, committing arson, murdering their owners, as Celia did, Milton McLaurin laid out in Celia Slave. And there were others who participated in other, not full-scale insurrections, but definitely armed revolt on their various farms and plantations. And so just like Driven Toward Madness, there's all of these anecdotal pieces that I'm trying to pull together, just mentions, like we know that Nat Turner had a wife. We know that Charles Dessalons had a few women helping him in his revolt. And so it's painstakingly gratifying. So I'm trying to, basically challenge the narrative that insists that Black women largely committed covert and or less direct, more passive forms of resistance. And so I'm insisting, yes, we also, committed, some very brutal and bloody resistance as well. And so that's a project in its beginning stages, and I'm very excited about it. Hopefully that maybe my last history book.
Well, definitely. We at the African American Studies channel would love to have you back on the channel to be able to talk about that book, because it definitely sounds like a project that is going to readjust the narrative on really what not only the capabilities of Black women were, because clearly Margaret Garner is a case to it, but also really about what they actually did and how vocal and how active they actually were, which isn't what you get in a lot of the popular histories. And so thank you so much, Dr. Taylor, for spending time with us. We know it's the end of the semester, and so, it's a real busy, busy time. And so we at the African American Studies Channel definitely appreciate your time, and definitely please tell our listeners not bye, but see you later.
Thank you so much, Adam, for having me.